Welcome to the Production First Mindset, a podcast where we discuss the world of building code from the lab all the way to production. We explore the tactics, methodologies, and metrics used to drive real customer value by the engineering leaders actually doing it. I'm your host, Liran Chemovich, CTO and co-founder of Rookout. Today, I'm hosting Anton Druch, Tech Executive Mentor and previously VP of Engineering at Snyk. We'll be discussing his personal experiences building and operating SaaS at scale. Thank you for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Anton, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure thing. So on top of the introduction you just gave me, my name is Anton and I've been in engineering leadership positions for, I would say, almost two decades now. Recently, I've decided to take a deep dive into the world of helping other engineering leaders with my own experience. And for the majority of the past year, I've been partnering with CTOs and VPEs in order to help them skip my mistakes of scaling engineering organizations. Prior to that, and this is where I gained most of my professional experience, I joined Snyk as the first employee and led the growth of our engineering organization to almost 150 people across 5 years. That has been a very dense, packed, and intense professional experience. It has taught me a lot, and I hope I'll be able to share some of those lessons on our chat today.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have a very unique view of production, of how things are looking, so kind of, can you share with us what's that like?
I think maybe unique is too strong of a word because I don't think I'm the only person to hold on to such an attitude. But I will say that not only at Snyk, but since my very beginning of my professional career, it always felt to me that I was somewhat more interested in what the real world looks like as opposed to your private IDE in which you just wrote the best code you've ever written. And I was always drawn to where the magic was happening, which is where your software runs, where your product is basically interacting with its users, and so on. And a lot of what I've done to discover my professional competitive advantage, if you will, was to hone this attitude and to see how I can make the most out of it. So my view is that we can achieve much more as engineers, as people who build products, by feeling more and more comfortable in the production environment of whatever it is that we build. And it doesn't have to be cast out to ops people. No, I'm a software engineer. I write code. We have SREs or DevOps people or whatnot in our org. They run and maintain things. And you can actually get quite a unique perspective if you combine these two aspects together.
How did that view mature as you moved from engineering roles to leadership roles?
What started as a great way of getting more details, seeing how the system operates and checking in on the metrics and the logs and whatnot, slowly became this secret sauce I felt I was capable of giving my team in order to increase their own impact, be it leading the charge, so to speak, on production incidents. And I vividly remember people who have participated in some resolution of a production outage together with me would say after the fact, like, wow, you really like it. No one likes it, but you do. And also, as time goes by and you are less and less involved in the daily details of the engineers on your team, and they know way more than you do, you start thinking about what kind of a critical perspective can you provide to actually help them. Because if you ask them to run you through all the details that led them to the decision that they have, that will be very wasteful for both of your time. So instead, asking questions such as, what will it look like in our production environment once you deploy this code? What will tell you that it is doing the right thing? And how will you know if it does the wrong thing became sort of my personal trademarked questions that rely a lot on my expectation of people knowing what to expect in production. But somehow constantly, despite being very repetitive for me, still were quite meaningful to the people on my team.
Mm-hmm. Now, early on in my career, I've learned that the definition of done is one of the key elements in getting software engineering just right. How is that for you? What's a good definition of done for you? How do you instill it in your teams?
I agree that the definition of done is sort of the first step towards a philosophical approach to your role as a leader that that you can take, where you try to identify this pattern or distill something in the way decisions are being made. Again, saying, what's the simplest thing I can add to the mix that will bring the most value? And sometimes, most of the times, discussing the definition of done is that small thing. Definition of done really shows how your organization is structured, how people perceive their own responsibilities and accountabilities. We all have to draw the line somewhere, right? You eat breakfast, you didn't grow the wheat to bake the bread, right? So your definition of done to making breakfast doesn't include going out into the field. So if we take this back into our engineering world, where do you start from and where do you finish your work is very, very important to frame your flow. Most of the organizational problems also stem from inconsistencies in this definition. And again, there's plenty of research showing things like hospitals wanting to minimize mistakes, people's lives are involved, and then they research when do incidents happen, and they figure out that incidents happen most of the time when shifts change, when people pass the baton mm-hmm. to one another. So, and we do that all the time in engineering, right? We pass the baton with every Jira ticket. We basically pass the baton onto our product managers, onto our customer support people, onto our users. So minimizing the friction and the risk there is very worthwhile. The definition of done should be stretched and to allow people to go outside of their comfort zone gently, but constantly. And one of the easier ways to stretch the definition of done is to ask yourself how much more running it can you add on top of the building it part? Because everyone would want to include pushing code to the main branch of your repo as part of your definition of done. But if you say, yeah, but we only demo things on the real production environment, you cannot demo something complete by using anything that our users do not have access to, is a very effective thought exercise to see whether it symbolizes something important in your organization or can help you do better.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that a bit of a scary experience, kind of limiting yourself to only demoing stuff in production?
You know, there's this definition of beauty, that beauty is not achieved when there is nothing to add, but instead beauty is achieved when there's nothing left to take away. And I think you need to be really, really selective about what you stand for, what you consider to be done. So I actually find it very liberating in a sense to say there are so many moving parts in everything that we do. If we keep on growing the checklist of, oh, we messed up on the documentation aspect, so from now on, every definition of done also includes, please show me the documentation for this feature, internal or user-facing or whatnot, you will drive your productivity into the ground. People will outsource their accountability to making things done. But instead, if you say the definition of done is in the eyes of our users, and if we think something is done, we need to be able to show how our users would experience it end to end. It forces many things on you. For example, to be able to demonstrate this feature you've just worked on from the user perspective. How would it feel for a user to even encounter that new flow? Like, where would they find it? What would they provide to this flow? Is it just a button they need to click or do they need to do more? How will they consume the output of this feature and how valuable will it be for them? There's always something that kind of puzzled me. There's a lot of, I don't know, phonetic resemblance between the word product and production. But in most of the organizations I know, these are very distinct parts. It's like product management is all about deciding what needs to be done. And the production environment is, that's the red tape around something that is very sacred. But you can either do one or the other. You can either handle a production outage or participate in a product management discussion, right? It's never both at the same time.
Yeah.
But I think we're missing out in the split.
Yeah, it's definitely ironic that they are almost the same and yet worlds apart.
Worlds apart.
Oh.
And, you know, it's a bleaker picture than reality that I'm painting. A very strong silver line connecting everything together has to be around analytics and engagement in the world of SaaS and B2C even more. Tracking your user behavior is really bringing these two worlds closer together, which also lends itself to, well, so this feature is now in production, but if we cannot say how useful our users are finding it, have we really released it? Is it really done?
Mm-hmm. Don't you feel that when people think of production, they imagine servers and containers and databases and all those, you know, building blocks?
I think it's an early starting point. When you're busy building everything, you think about the building blocks. And I have a personal experience in this, having arranged our wedding. My wife and I got married 13 years ago. Having arranged our wedding, you start looking at, you no longer enjoy other people's weddings, right? The way you used to. Because suddenly you are aware of all these decisions made and the colors of the napkins on the tables and whatnot. And, well, you enjoy it, but you are much more aware of what is happening behind the scenes. And it changes your perception. So yeah, once you start building systems, you get tainted with inspecting everything, trying to remove the curtain and see how it's built. But you have much to gain from actually letting go of that and constantly shifting to this user mindset. And like, think about your email service, right? You would be using Gmail or something of that sort. You use it a lot. Do you really think about the servers behind it? Do you care whether it's what services it runs on and how it operates?
For Gmail, no.
A good experience.
In Outlook in the past, you would have thought of the servers. You know, Microsoft Exchange and all that.
Because it was so slow that you had time to think things through, right? You would say, why is this hourglass still spinning? But no, when the way you try to build your own products today, you have much to gain from respecting your users' attention spans. And you don't have to be a UX designer to do that. You just need to say, have we asked the user to invest as little as they could to gain this immense value we think we have in store for them? And again, this is the product mindset of the things, and I think it relates very highly to the production mindset.
Mm-hmm. And what happens when things don't work out so well?
There is an immense amount of failure modes in everything, in products, in software, but especially in organizations. And I love failure modes in organizations. You would see so many different things, but I think they come down to just a couple of patterns. One pattern is people feeling overwhelmed and feeling stretched and just not playing along with what is being said. It's like lip service. Yes, we build it, we run it, yada, 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 but I'm not being given the tools nor the time nor the autonomy to do what I think is right. So I'm not really participating in this. And you would see a lot of pushback, sometimes passive, sometimes more active, but people's eyes would sort of fade out a bit when you talk about the production mindset. Another failure mode is a situation where you overdo it, where you kind of miss out on the balance of doing too much of any single thing is eventually counterproductive. And people may misinterpret your drive towards production excellence and basically say, wow, there is so much, an endless amount of improvements we can make here. And then say, hey, why settle for 3 nines of uptime? Let's go for 4 nines of uptime without appreciating the immense investment of effort that will be required for that, and asking yourself, yeah, but is it worth it? So I would say that the second failure mode is not knowing when to stop, constantly seeing imperfection as something that needs to be addressed. As leaders, we really need to know where to draw the line and how to see both the glass half full of what we have accomplished, how much are we giving our users, given the investment that we make in our production environment, but at the same time, also appreciating the glass half empty, saying, yeah, this could be better. We could be at like 4 nines instead of 3 nines, but it's okay. The ripple effect of missing out on that 4th 9 of uptime is something manageable. We aren't being, it's not a paper cut every time it happens.
And today, as you're walking and coaching with engineering leaders in various organizations, how do you help them know where to draw the line? What's good enough?
So I'm working today with a variety of organizations, especially in sizes and levels of maturity. And what I'm seeing is that, yes, there are different approaches to production mindsets between early stage companies where 3 developers, we have 2.5 users, and large organizations that are responsible for a much bigger operational challenge, thinking how to structure their org, not to draw the lines too harshly between building and owning or running. And what I can say is that you need to choose the right reason to invest in this. And the right reason is really impacted by where you are as a company, what stage you're in as a company. Early on, it seems like any investment in scale readiness isn't worth it, because you just need to prove that you're onto something and you're so, like, the MVP is so M and so not V, that you must rush forward with more features. So yeah, I wouldn't force anything on top of it saying, no, this is a very short-sighted view, you must invest in scalability or whatnot. Instead, I would say, think about doubling the team that you have today in size and ask yourself, what can you do today to guarantee that the velocity of your team will not go down as it grows? And then suddenly questions such as, what do we expect from our developer environment versus the production environment? How easy or hard should it be to transfer something that works locally into something that works for everyone? Becomes a very important question and encompasses a lot of your production engineering, I would say. It's not just about, oh, let's use Docker Compose on our laptops or whatnot and we'll be better off. You cannot decide meaningful decisions about your developer environment without thinking about your production environment at the same time. When a company grows, yes, you start thinking more about the safety of your changes, how to basically solve 2 problems. Mistakes will happen, and that's okay, but how can we guarantee that the ripple effect of our mistakes will be manageable? It cannot be a make or break situation for the company every time we have a bad deployment. Good examples for that would be, again, from the organizational perspective, ask yourself, how hard or easy is it for you to roll back a bad change? And by hard or easy, I don't mean the technical aspects of it, I mean the organizational aspects of it. Do people feel empowered to say, I actually shouldn't have pushed this to production, I will now roll this back? Or is there a situation where most of the time, someone higher up the chain, maybe even you, would need to step in and say, folks, I think we need to roll this back. And people will play along because you are who you are and you have your role.
Yeah.
But maybe rolling something back is considered a failure and people don't want to admit failure. You would want to work on that.
There is one question I like asking all of my guests. So, you know, I deal a lot with bugs and debugging. So I'm wondering for you, what's the single bug that you remember the most from those 2 decades of software engineering?
So bugs are kind of like children. You like everybody's children, but you like you love yours the most. And one memorable thing comes to mind when I came back from a few days off and we were in the stage at Sneak quite early on, but we got the hang of something with our users and the system would grow in numbers daily. And I just took a sweep, like, okay, what's the size of the database tables? What's the request latency? Like, getting to know the production environment back again. And I saw something that I didn't like. So I decided that some technical debt of some inefficiency in our database schema and some dangling objects that were just taking up space, now was the right time to handle this. And I deleted a lot of production data, real needed production data, as I thought I was deleting useless data. That turned into a memorable chain of events that is hard to forget right now, but gave me the immense opportunity to sort of serve as an example for, yeah, we all make stupid mistakes. We need a stronger, different set of processes to prevent this from happening. I'm not exempt. I'm even more prone than others because I think I know things that I'm overly confident. So that was one issue. I don't know if you call it a bug, but yeah, for some of our users, that was quite a bug. Another example is actually not mine, but it's amazing to see very small, very contained problems at scale. I was working for Checkpoint and we got so lucky. It was the Halloween weekend of, I don't know, maybe 2011. And long story short, many ATM machines operated by Checkpoint's customers were offline for 2 hours across the world at the same time. You know, you can make a Hollywood movie out of this, like when that would be the opening scene of something very colossal going down. And my team was tasked with figuring out what just happened. And when we found the bug, it was really, really interesting. There was a scheduled task system that had an overflow with its timer variable and basically thought that was confused between future and past, so to speak. Luckily for everyone, it was confused just for 2 hours and then it sorted itself out. So it was amazing to see how impactful small problems can be at a very large scale and also how much luck plays a role in all of this. Yeah, the Halloween weekend is quite the downtime for these systems as much as it can be. And the fact that the bug sort of sorted itself out after 2 hours and could have been left alone for the next decade. Yeah, exactly. You need to appreciate these karma moments because not everything is dreadful when production goes down.
Well, Anton, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So that's a wrap on another episode of the Production First Mindset. Please remember to like, subscribe, and share this podcast. Let us know what you think of the show and reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Production First. Thanks again for joining us.